Way back in the late 60s, my generation saw the crumble of the fairy tales we had been raised on. We watched the Vietnam War escalating for no good purpose as our leaders lied to us. We watched the civil rights movement gain momentum and some ground, but then Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, and the privileged, those who were born on third base and thought they had hit a triple, learned how to work around the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and keep down those who were so powerless they couldn't even get into the stadium. Much of our protest music, which I still love, we had terrible clothes, but our music has endured. Haircuts weren't so good either, but much of that music was idealistic. Like Joni Mitchell's classic song, Woodstock, with the refrain, "We are stardust, we are golden, and we've got to get ourselves back to the garden." I encourage you to listen to it if you've never heard it. Communes cropped up, you know, filled with idealistic, well-meaning flower children, and trying to recreate that biblical first garden, garden of peace and beauty, where there's harmony between God and creation and human beings, no matter their color, their class, or their country. And we can maybe rightly make fun of the naivete, but there's also something we can learn from these long-haired flower children. They had a picture in their minds of a future that was more just and less violent than the status quo. Maybe, surely, there's something in each human heart that imagines an idyllic past that, in the face of the horrors of empire, we're controlled by the few who control the many. We all have this sense of, surely there's a place we can get back to. It's interesting, however, the biblical story, which begins in the garden, Genesis 3, ends not in a garden, but in a city. We heard it today. In the spirit, the angel showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. A city where there's no temple because God's presence is experienced everywhere. There's no separation between sacred and secular. A city where there's no sun or moon because everything is ablaze with the glory of God. A city where the gates never close so the nations can stream in. A city that has a garden in the middle of it, where a river runs through it, the river of the water of life, and on each side of that river is the tree of life, producing those magnificent 12 different fruit, and its leaves heal the nations. The new Jerusalem, the city of God, is run not by the fear of death, but by the abundance of life. And of course, this image of the city of God on the new earth is not just about the future, though it is that. It's about what God is doing here and now, what God is dreaming and working for those who have ears to hear and eyes to see, for those who are, like us, already baptized citizens of the city of God, which is becoming. And so we might rightfully ask, well, what's the church's role in our current cities and towns? I like how Brian Zond in a recent tweet put it, quote, "It's the task of every local church to be a suburb of New Jerusalem." To be a suburb of New Jerusalem. Well, what does that look like? Well, we have an image in the gospel reading today. Jesus is walking among a crowd of the blind, the lame, and the paralyzed. I mean, we see these kind of places in, you know, in photographs overseas, in these medical field stations, in refugee camps that are just overcrowded with the sick and the injured. I mean, it's just such a depressing sight. And Jesus is in one of those kind of places. There's probably hardly any room to stand, and the smell alone will keep out most of us. And he's been announcing, right, the arrival of the city of God, but that doesn't keep him from visiting those places where God's reign obviously has not fully arrived. And yet he's not just an observer taking notes, but he engages this one man who's been sick for 38 years. And Jesus asks, do you want to be made well? Do you want to be made well? Some readers through the years have said, well, Jesus is rebuking the man. Obviously, it's the man's fault. He's been sick so long. He doesn't want to get well. Because he is, they might say, as my grandmother used to often say, you know, she's enjoying poor health. You know what that means. He's getting so much attention from friends and family, he's afraid if he gets well, that'll all go away. Nobody will ask him to dinner. No one will send him a card. But this poor man has just the opposite problem, right? He has no one to help him get into the pool when the waters are ripe for healing. He's alone. And that's not an indictment on him, but of his city. Someone could have arranged, some of you could have arranged a team, all right, a team of helpers to help these folks get into the pool. But apparently they didn't think of it or just didn't want to be in that kind of sad, ugly place. Well, Jesus doesn't discuss it with him any further and simply says, stand up, take your mat, and walk. And we notice a couple of things. Jesus gives a command, which the man, if he has indeed been made well, can obey or not obey. He still has a role to play, even though his healing is a free, unmerited gift. And second, as far as we know, Jesus doesn't heal anyone else who is there. But he also doesn't get caught in the mental trap that so often paralyzes me and others. You know, we hear the voice in the head say, well, the problem is so big, my effort wouldn't make any difference at all. I mean, I was just reading some statistics. Take the suicide epidemic from 1997 to 2017. Suicide rates have increased by 45% for men ages 45 to 64. And they've increased 62% for women in that age group. Or the loneliness epidemic is growing so fast. 35% of those over the age of 45 are chronically lonely. Chronically lonely. I mean, what do you do with that? How can we do that? I mean, Jesus is just one man. He can't heal everyone. But by God, he's willing to heal this man as the Father directs. And in so doing, he changes that man's life forever. And there's a ripple effect of goodness and beauty that goes out with that one man. And he's also painting and pointing, creating a sign of what the kingdom of God, the city of God will look like when it comes in its fullness. The writer Iris Murdoch says, man is a creature who makes pictures of himself and then comes to resemble the picture. If our inner picture of the future is like so many of the movies I sometimes see, you know, they just have these horrible dystopian futures. Everybody's walking around, it looks like the surface of the moon is just horrible. If that's your image, that's what's going to happen. But if the image of the city of God is so burned into our minds and hearts, we know that even the smallest act of kindness is striking a blow for a future of justice and beauty. Heard about a recent book that David Brooks has just published. He's an op-ed writer for the Times and author. He was being interviewed by Oprah. I encourage you to go listen to that podcast. He talked about a woman who lived in Chicago in the Inglewood neighborhood, and she's moving out because it's just gotten too dangerous. But then she looks out her window and sees an empty lot across the street, and there are two young girls playing with broken bottles. And she tells her husband, we're not leaving. We're not about to leave. We're not going to be just another family who runs away. And now she heads a nonprofit that is fixing up neighborhoods. That's a sign of the city of God coming. Brooks, in that book, the title I should give you is The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life. He gets very personal about his own failure and the collapse of his life as he goes from the first mountain of success to the second mountain. But he lists sort of six stages, you are all familiar with these, where the motivational shift happens in a person. It starts, of course, number one, material pleasure, having a nice car, a nice home, nice food. Number two is ego pleasure, becoming well-known or rich and successful, winning victories and recognition. Number three, intellectual pleasure, learning about things, understanding the world around us. Number four, generativity, the pleasure we get in giving back to others and serving our communities. So many of you practice generativity. Number five, fulfilled love, receiving and giving love, the rapturous union of souls. And number six, transcendence, the feeling we get, he says, when living in accordance with some ideal. The ideal for every church is to be a suburb of the city of God. Without a living image of the city of God, we'll end up building the city of me and my tribe. With that image of the city of God, we have a blueprint of God's dream for creation. And we follow Jesus, who leads the way because he is the way. So Joni Mitchell was mostly right. We are stardust. We are golden. And we have to go forward to the city being built by God.